So the particular discretization method that I introduced last time is called spectral methods. In a spectral method, the function is expanded into a set of basis functions. You all remember that, but you want to tell me what to write you down. I try to get that more interactive. That probably helps you to learn something. I call the function f. So we have f of x equals. That's your cue. A sum over, exactly.
Ci and then the basis, your ith basis function.
Ci, the coefficients, and some basis functions, bi, that depend on x. And we use the Legendre polynomials for that, pl. Of course, there are many other basis functions to be used as well. And next, I introduced a way to calculate these coefficients if a function f is given. And for that, we also needed a dot product. And the dot product was given by the integral from minus 1 to plus 1. Of course, I chose the Legendre polynomials. The integral that you're using, the dot product depends on the basis functions. So in our case, we have a dot product between two functions f and g, and that was given by the integral of f of x, g of x, dx. And to calculate these coefficients, we projected f onto the basis functions. And I'm just going to write it down in two steps. How did it look like? So we have the, on the left-hand side, integral f of x times a basis function bi of x dx. And that was given by, and after some reformulation, because you can exchange the sum and the integral, then you had, not want to get it wrong, sum over, since it's just I here, now we have to sum over j, cj, and here that integral, f of x, dj of x, dx, what? No nonsense. Sorry, let me change the order here, just to be more exact. We multiply with bi from the left. Bi, this bi, and this bj used to be I here. And then we also assume that the basis functions are orthogonal. That may or may not be the case. But if we assume that, then independent of that, this is given by some fixed matrix mij, which was called the mass matrix. For historical reasons, and in our case, it was diagonal because of orthogonality. Because the basis is orthogonal. And in the notebook that I wrote, I moved a bit quickly. I should have explicitly introduced and calculated this mass matrix ahead of time, because you can do that. And I calculated it numerically because I was lazy, but you don't need to do that, because if you know your basis, you can easily look up what the overlap between, what the norm of the individual basis functions is. And next I introduced how to calculate a derivative. This is the front. And I want to go over that in a bit more detail. So if we have a function like f of x here, let me modify it. F of x equals the sum ci bi of x, and we calculate the derivative of x. Then the only thing that depends on x is the basis function. Coefficients do not depend on x. So if we calculate a derivative, f prime, then we just calculate the derivative of the basis functions. And the next step was to expand the derivatives of the basis functions again and do basis functions. I skipped that last time. Let's go through that, because that tells us how we actually calculate the matrix D that I introduced last time. The matrix It allows us to calculate derivatives, and we need to calculate d, so it makes sense to go through that in a bit more detail. So to expand that function in terms of basis functions, we can repeat the same process. We multiply from left with the I. The function that we are expanding is now this function here, c, renaming the indices again, bj prime of x, dx. On the right-hand side, we get sum over, now I don't want to be confused with the indices, we have coefficients. What do we get now? Okay, I'm confused now. Please help me out. It's the blackboard effect because I'm standing right in front of it. Let me just write it out. Who knows what happens here? Cj. And yes, I'm just pulling out the sum and the coefficients, and then we have an integral, and then we have di of x, and here the prime, which is the gradient. And this here, of course, is the overlap integral between the basis function and the derivatives of the basis functions, and we can also calculate that ahead of time, and this is the matrix that is usually called dij, so that I'm calling dij. And of course, since we know the basis functions, this can also be calculated ahead of time. And I did that very quickly last time. I'm afraid I did it too quickly. And really, guys, this is not a large class. There are not 200 people, so you can be more active. You can tell me whether you understand that, whether you are bored, or whether this is too fast for you. So I'm expecting more feedback here. So let's just do that, but a bit more carefully last time. We are going to write down the first three Legendre polynomials and the derivatives of the Legendre polynomials, and then we are going to expand the derivatives of the Legendre polynomials in terms of the Legendre polynomials. So. Let's do that, and I hope we get it right this time. I want to write down the Legendre polynomial, so it's L and PL of x, and 0, 1, and 2. This is just constant, and this is x. And the next one, can you look it up? I think you got it wrong last time.
1/2 3x² minus 1.
1/2 or 3/2?
1/2, and then in brackets, 3x² minus 1.
Like that? Minus 1?
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah, I got that wrong. Good. And now let's write down the derivative of the Legendre polynomials. I can get the first one here, and the second one is then, oh God, this term drops out. This is 3 over 2 times 2. This is 3x, is it not? Okay, thank you. Thank you. And now I want to take, okay, let's do one more. Because when it's trivial, it's always difficult to see what happens. What's the next one? You're probably looking on Wikipedia or Mathematica?
Yeah, some random website. So hopefully they're good. 1/2 times by 5x³ minus 3x.
x³ minus 3x.
5x³ minus 3x.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. And the derivative is then one half 15x squared, is that correct? Minus 3? Okay, yeah, I hope it's easy. Okay. And now I want to expand these functions in terms of these functions. And I want you to do that. So for 0, it's easy. That is equal 0. And how do we expand this function in terms of Chebyshev polynomials? What is that? This is just P0 of x. So here, I want linear combinations of all the Legendre polynomials. What can we write for here? How is that expanded in Legendre polynomials?
3 times P1x.
3 times P1 of x. Yes, and this one is a bit more complicated, but we should do that. What is that? Okay, the most complicated term is the x squared term here. So we need some P2 here. And this 1/2 is probably just fine, and I think it's just 5P2. And now we need to get rid of the remainder here, right? If we have 5P2, then we get minus 5 here. Just ignoring the 1/2 factors, minus 5. We already have a minus 3, so we need a plus 2, and that would be plus 2p0 of x, and no idea whether this is correct.
Isn't it just plus 1 because of the half? Because you add plus 2, but then you also get the half.
Plus 1p0? That could be. Anyway, you see how it goes. Obviously, we can ask Mathematica, and I'm sure if you find the right random web page, this is all nicely written down here. And now we can write this, of course, as vectors as well. If we write this as a vector, I mean, this is trivial. So we write this as a vector, then this would be, since it's 1p0, this is 1p0, 0, 0, 0. Let's write this down. This is 1 times p0, no p1, no p2, no p3. And if we write this as a vector, this becomes
0, 3, 0, 0.
And if you write this as a vector, this becomes 1, 0, 5, 0. And now, if we have a function that is expanded in Chebyshev polynomials, then we have such a vector. And so let's assume we have a function that is already expanded, and we have a vector of coefficients. And the vector of coefficients, we have f of x, and since we have expanded it, a vector of coefficients, the coefficients are c0, c1, c2, and c3. And we want to calculate the derivative of that. Then what is this going to be? Now it's a bit complicated. First, let's assume we have only the C0 coefficient. We can look up what happens, and of course the C0 coefficient will drop out because its derivative is 0. That is easy. Now let's look at the C1 coefficient. that corresponds to having just p1. P1 derivative is just p0. So this gives us a term of this vector here. Oh. This is the 1, 0, 0, 0 that we have in the second row up there, multiplied by the c1 coefficient. Now let's do the same with the c2 coefficient. We have only the p2 polynomial. Its derivative is 3 times p1. So this is plus 0 plus 3 c2 plus 0 plus 0. And for the c3 coefficient, we get a similar thing. That is 1 and 5 plus c0 plus 0 plus 5. And this is just the linear combination of these coefficients. So we can write it in terms as a matrix. And this is some matrix here times this coefficient c0. Oh, I need to write nicer. C0, c1, c2, c3. And can you tell me how this matrix looks like? The first coefficient is c0. If you take this vector and put it in, the c0 is going to meet all the coefficients in the first column. And since c0 drops out, the first column is going to be all zeros. The second column is going to meet the c1s. We only have one c1 here. This is 1, 0, 0, 0. C2 is going to meet the third row. And there we have only one non-zero element. This is 3. So let me write the other zeros in here. And the coefficient c3, c3 is going to meet the fourth column. So there we need to put the 1, 0, 5, 0 in there. And of course, in reality, that matrix is larger because these vectors would be larger and so on. Now this matrix here, of course, it's known. I'm sure if you go to Wikipedia, it shows you how to calculate that matrix ahead of time. You can also calculate it numerically by evaluating this integral here for the Chebyshev polynomials. You can also get a similar matrix. Looks different, of course, for Chebyshev polynomials, Fourier polynomials, or whatever you want to do. And this is this matrix Dij. So if you have a function given in terms of coefficients, you multiply it with this matrix, and then you get the derivative. And to get the second derivative, you multiply it with such a matrix again. And you notice that this matrix is not invertible. For every n where you cut it off, there is one row that is 0, the last row. And obviously, the first column is going to be 0 as well. So let's now write down a particular partial differential equation that we are going to solve, the Poisson equation in one dimension. And the Poisson equation is just the simplest elliptic equation that one can solve. It's just a Laplacian of some unknown function, phi of x is equal to some whatever. Call it rho of x. Rho of x is called the right-hand side. You remember when we talked about ODEs, there was a right-hand side, and the right-hand side was the important function that we wanted to solve. Here, this is also called the right-hand side, but it's not anything important. It's just the kind of the bits on the right-hand side. So this is the unknown. We're looking for that. This is given. And what else is given when you solve an equation like that? for an elliptic equation, you typically also have boundary conditions. If you solve for Newtonian potential, then the boundary condition would be something like, oh, at infinity, the potential is zero. It's a bit inconvenient to deal with infinity, so here we're going to use another example. For example, things like a guitar string. And instead of potential, it's the, say, the deviation, how far the string is currently moving. Well, we're not going to look at the guitar string because that is a time-dependent problem as well. I'm going to want to solve a simpler problem, but for example, you can have a chain that hangs down or something, and then the boundary condition is what happens there. So a boundary condition and is then that phi at the boundary is also given to something. Let's call it, I want to call it B for boundaries. B is already basis function. A different name, C, D, E, F. Let's call it F. No, not F. Let's call it G. At the boundary. So if you want to solve a differential equation, it's very important. You need to have not only the equation, but in this case, there's a right-hand side that needs to be given, and also some kind of boundary condition. Without the boundary condition, you can't solve it. Let's choose a particular n, for example, n equals 4, or n equals 3, actually. That's the case that we have here. And if we then we have four coefficients, c0 to c3, and if we take a second derivative of this, then we take the square of this matrix. This is one zero eigenvalue. If we take the square, it would have two zero eigenvalues. So if we write this out as an equation discretized, then we have phi of x equals, well, that's the sum over basis functions. We can also do that for, okay, let me call these phi I now. And rho of x, these are the unknowns, because we're looking for the function phi, we're expanding it theoretically, but we don't know what the phi I are. We're also expanding the function rho, let's call these rho I, and since rho is given, we can calculate the rho I, just using the projecting it onto the basis functions. The rho are given, and this equation, if we write it in terms of coefficients, then it looks like dij, abstract index notation, djk, phi k, that is phi, first derivative, second derivative, and this is equal to rho I. This is given, this is the unknown. And since D has one zero eigenvalue, this has two zero eigenvalues. So for n equals 3, if we have four unknowns, then this just gives us two conditions. We cannot calculate the remaining phi because the derivative operator has a kernel. And this is why we need the boundary conditions. And let's assume that the boundary is at, let's assume the domain goes from minus 1 to plus 1. Of course, I'm assuming that because that makes it easier to deal with the Legendre polynomials. Then we have two boundary conditions, and the boundary conditions would be just the value of phi at minus 1 and plus 1. So let's just write that out. Then we have phi minus 1 equals g minus 1, phi plus 1 equals g plus 1, and how do these boundary conditions look like if we discretize it? What is phi of minus 1? We know how phi looks like, so we need to take the respective sum here. phi of minus 1 is just phi I phi of minus 1, that is the sum of all the coefficients, equals g is also given. And we have the other boundary condition here. And this is a dot product, sum over I. So this is giving us one condition. This other boundary condition here gives us another condition. So these are two conditions. And this gives us the other conditions with yourself. So what we need to do now, and I can't show you that, we need to assemble a large matrix that contains all these conditions. So if we have n equals 3, then we have four unknowns, four phi I. So we need a matrix with four rows and four columns. So we're getting two of these rows and columns from the boundary conditions. And sorry, we're getting, yeah, two from the boundary conditions and all the other things from this conditions for various values of I. But we need to ignore the ones where we have the zero rows. You probably need to cut off the two bottom rows, which is where the zeros are going to be in this notation. Now, my original plan was to demonstrate that in a notebook and solve the system. And then I don't know what you have. For example, you can choose a constant rho, and then you have some kind of boundary condition, and then look the solution in one dimension, and it looks quite nice. I cannot demonstrate that today, because so I'm going to demonstrate it on Monday. Given that, I'm asking you, do you have more questions about this? Would you feel halfway comfortable implementing that? I mean, I said something about matrices and assembling and so on. There is a bit of low-level work there. I'm going to show you that on Monday, but it's a bit more complicated. Okay, if you have no questions about this, I want to move on, because this is just a one-dimensional equation. And obviously, a one-dimensional equation is an ODE. And this is a section about PDEs. So now I'm going to demonstrate how to solve such a thing in two dimensions, or an arbitrary number of dimensions. If you want to solve a PDE, say on the surface of the sphere, then you can expand functions there into spherical harmonics. Then you have not just one coefficients L, but two coefficients L and M. So everything becomes a bit more complicated. Everywhere where I write sums over I or over j, you'd have Lm or L prime M prime and so on. And you probably want to choose an L max. And for every L, you want to have all the respective M's. I'm assuming you're all familiar with that. But apart from that, it would work just the same way. And a similar thing you can do if you want to find a solution of a function in a square. Let's assume we have a square here. It goes from minus 1 to plus 1 in both directions. And we can easily come up with a set of basis functions for that. So you have a function that lives on the square f of x and y. And similar in the way in which you need to sum over L and M, you now have two indices over which to sum. There's still only one coefficient for each pair. So the coefficients now carry two indices. And the basis function that you could choose could, for example, be Legendre polynomials x multiplied, pi of x times pj of y. So you take products of 1D basis functions, tensor products, to get 2D basis functions. And that obviously extends to higher dimensions as well. So if you want to solve something in 3D, you can take a similar ansatz here. It's called a tensor product because, I mean, for each I, there's a j, and so on, and so forth. And if you then have a list of coefficients, it becomes a bit more complicated. because you still have a vector of coefficients, but on the other hand, you're using two indices to label these coefficients. So that's probably easiest to imagine that if you think about YLM. So if you have YLM, then you have coefficients that are called CLM. And if you write these coefficients as a vector has only one index, but with two indices, YLM, we need to somehow package up the two indices into a single vector. There's no math behind it. It's just relabeling indices. It's tedious, very easy to make mistakes. So let's just write them down as a long vector. And then, of course, we have C00. Next, we might choose C, what L equals 1? 1 minus 1, C10, C1 plus 1, C2 minus 2, C2 minus 1, and so on and so forth. It doesn't matter in which order you write them down, but you need to write them all down the same order all the time. And of course, if you have a computer code, it is tedious, because sometimes you need to know the L's and M's because you want to evaluate the YLM. And sometimes you just have, oh, it's the fifth index. And then you need to go forth and back and need to do a bit of rearranging there. And the same thing, of course, works in this case here. Let's assume that we both go up to N. And in this case, you have, of course, the basis functions are given by Pi times Pj. The coefficients are Caj. And if you write these down, then we have C00, C01, C02, C03. Let's assume N is 3. And then you have C10, C11, C12, and so on and so forth. So it goes in the same way, but you shouldn't be confused that you have two indices here, and when you package them up in a vector, it's only one index. And then you also have matrices, derivative matrices, and then it becomes even more complicated because matrices have two indices, and then if you break it up, it's four of these values, I and j, that you have for these matrices.
So in terms of like using Legendre polynomials, it'll be quite a lot easier because you essentially just have your vectors as like a Kronecker product of like blocks of equal size. But then with spherical harmonics, your L, I think M runs from minus L to...
Yes, it does.
So like yes. Putting that into, packaging that into a vector is quite a lot harder. So I mean that's...
Yeah, I mean if you have the L's and M's, you can just go through the vector top to bottom and package them up.
Okay.
Going the other way is a bit more complicated. And one trick is that all the loops you have in terms of L and M, and then calculating this index in terms of L's and M's. I think there's an L squared in there or something if you want to do that. But you can actually directly calculate that position here. That is possible. And it's one of them. I mean, it's just inconvenient that that's necessary.
Yeah, but I guess if you have like a problem with spherical symmetry, you'll probably get better like accuracy and convergence when using spherical harmonics.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to, say, if you're doing Legendre polynomials on a problem with spherical symmetry.
Yes. Okay. I haven't spoken about convergence yet.
Yeah.
So if you have a function that lives on the sphere, and you decide to expand it in Legendre polynomials in both theta and phi direction, this does not work well, because then you need partial derivatives in the theta and in the phi direction, and there are lots of problems near the pole. And I think it still converges, it's still well posed, but it converges really, really slowly. I think you need thousands of coefficients and so on. And you saw with the Legendre polynomials, we had that square, which just needed 8 coefficients, and it looked good. It converges really, really slowly. Okay. Yes, and of course, derivative matrices in this case, you have two derivative matrices. You have an X derivative, and you have a Y derivative. And they look rather simple, because the X derivative is independent of the index J. So it kind of, there are lots of repeated blocks in there. And the y derivative is independent of I in this ansatz. Again, lots of repeated indices there. Oh, and you see that this matrix here had many zeros in there. So if you want to write it down, you would use a sparse matrix to represent it. And you also see that all the non-zero values are actually in the top triangle. So that there are also other things you could do, but a sparse matrix would work. Okay. Oh, and the boundary condition in this case is also more complicated because you have boundary values for all these cases here. Then you, that is, it's just tedious to assemble the matrix because for all the interior points, you need to use the partial differential equations. And for all the boundary points, you need to see what happens there. I'm going to show you a code on Monday how we do that, how to solve that. Okay. Let me briefly think whether there is something else I want to say in this respect. I definitely need to mention convergence. I briefly showed last time that if you change n, the approximation, the error gets smaller. And you, whenever you solve something for a particular value of n, you cannot trust the solution. You always have to vary n and see how the solution changes. And at some point, of course, the solution changes less and less. And that is an indicator, not a proof, an indicator that the solution may be correct. If the solution changes a lot when you change n, then, I mean, then you're probably very far away from the true solution. Okay. I hope this is recorded or you're taking pictures of that. I'm going to circle back to that on Monday, and I want to show a different discretization method as well. This is a spectral method. A spectral method is very good if the function is smooth. Then you get this exponential convergence. But if the function is not smooth, then spectral methods have problems because you might need a lot of coefficients, and then other methods are easier to use. The other method I want to introduce is called finite differences. It's much less mathematical. There's much more index counting involved. It is really basic, really pedestrian, but many people use it, and you should have definitely heard it as well. Wanted to introduce the elegant method first. So let me just keep the blackboard here and start cleaning that blackboard here. That gives you a few minutes to think about things. While I clean the blackboard. So in a spectral method, we had basis functions that are kind of wiggly all over the domain, and the span, they are non-zero everywhere in the domain, and they are orthogonal to each other, and the orthogonality actually was a great helper when we divided by m and so on. That was not necessary. Another ansatz that is really good for choosing basis functions is to choose basis functions that have compact support. Because if they have compact support, then each basis function describes what happens in the function only in a small region of the domain. And in physics, many theories of physics are local. Things interact only when things are close together. So this is another advantage. So let me write down such kind of, let me sketch some kind of basis functions that have compact support. So this all goes by the name of, say, finite differences. Finite differences are usually introduced not in terms of basis functions, but you'd say, oh, we just sampled a function at various points. I don't like that, because if you sample a function at points, then your solution consists of some points where you sampled something. And I'm of the opinion if you solve a partial differential equation, the solution is a function. So you need to have a function. And it's not enough to know the value of the function at a few points. You actually want to have a full function. That's why I introduce basis functions. But of course, you can as well say, you know, the function at a few values, you just linearly interpolate between these values. And that's then the same thing. So it's just different points of view of the same thing. Anyway, the basis functions that you're going to use, they are zero everywhere. And then they look like this. Let me draw some points here. So these are equispaced points, a grid spacing. It's usually called H. And the functions are zero at all the points, except at one point, they are one. And so then they are linear. So these are piecewise linear functions. So you know, differentiability, smoothness, and so on, all the beautiful things we had earlier, it's all out the window. But the functions are very similar, simple, and clearly are, local. And the next basis function would look like this. And the next basis function would look like this, and like this, and so on. So for each of these grid points, there is one basis function that's one there. Each basis function is zero everywhere else. And then there are little traffic cones, triangles. And you have many of these. And if you represent a function in terms of these basis functions, then you get a function space of piecewise linear continuous functions. And they, in the same way as the Legendre polynomials, you can represent all analytic functions with that. But you need many more coefficients. The convergence is much slower, but this might be convenient. Are these orthogonal? They're not orthogonal. If you have orthogonal basis functions and you integrate a product of them, like with it, bi, bj, then this integral must vanish if I is not equal to j. These basis functions are positive everywhere. So if you calculate an overlap between two neighboring functions, that overlap is not going to be zero. So they're kind of almost orthogonal, because this basis function only has an overlap with the two neighboring basis functions, but they're not orthogonal. So we lose orthogonality, but this M matrix that you'd get out still is almost diagonal, because each basis function has an overlap only with the neighboring basis functions. And it's rather easy to calculate, because all the basis functions look the same, just shifted. And let me just sketch how that looks like. If you have a function f, and then since each basis function is 1 at one point and 0 everywhere else, you can sketch the coefficients easily in a way like this, where this point here says that the coefficient for the basis function that is non-zero here has that value. And if we reconstruct the corresponding function, then we just get linear interpolation. So the function that we represent then looks like this. And this is a typical picture you get for finite differences. And if we calculate the derivative operator, that comes out. I'm not going to do that. You can do that, but it's much less nice, because these functions here, of course, are defined in a piecewise manner, and then calculating the integrals. I mean, everything simplifies in the end, but there are lots of conditions because of the piecewise construction. The derivative, you need to be a bit careful, because the derivative, of course, in between these points here is nicely defined. It's always the same. But at a point, the derivative is, strictly speaking, not defined, because it's piecewise continuous. And it's not derivative doesn't exist. So not differentiable. Thank you. But if we calculate the corresponding integral over there, where we project the derivative onto the basis functions, that works out as well. That integral still exists. And to calculate a derivative in finite differences, there's a simple formula here. Let's call this good point I. And let's call these values, this is grid point I, and this is the function value, fi. Then the derivative of f at grid point I, the derivative of f at point I is then given by, let's write it like this. The value at of f I plus 1, that's the coefficient to the right, minus the coefficient to the left, divided by twice the grid spacing h. And you know, the approximation becomes better and better as we reduce the grid spacing. So if we add a limit, h goes to 0 to that, then we recover exactly the definition of the derivative operator. So I plus 1 is the next grid point over. If this is f of x, if we look at grid point I at the coordinate x, this is the grid point to the right, that is x plus h. This is the function value at x minus h divided by 2h. This is just the definition of the derivative operator. And this simple connection between what you do here, the finite difference, is where the method gets its name. And this is how it's usually introduced. You have this picture here where you have a function and you say you sampled the function here. And this is how you calculate a derivative. And this picture is correct for functions that are piecewise linear or continuous. What is usually skipped is the part where you project a function into that function space. And you can also write this as a matrix, this operator. Then this matrix looks like there's a 1 over 2h in the beginning. And then I'm going to skip what happens near the boundaries. And then this matrix is 0 on the diagonal, and there's a minus 1 here, and a plus 1 here, and everything is 0. This derivative operator is exactly this equation. This defines a linear operator. To calculate the derivative, you need to take the value to the left minus the value to the right. So if you have some set of coefficients for rho I, you look at the column to the left with a minus sign, this term here, the column to the right with a plus sign, and this overall factor of 1 over 2h that I pulled out. So if you calculate something with Legendre polynomials, you need to have a sketch on the blackboard, think about it, and so on. Calculating this derivative matrix, this is a bit complicated. As this finite differences, everything is much simpler, but the disadvantage is you probably need many more grid points. So for a spectral method, you might use 20 or 30 grid points. And for finite differences, you might use 1,000 grid points to do something. But still, this operator is sparse, so everything works nicely. And we can also do this in higher dimensions. I'm sorry that I'm moving so fast. I would like to give an example first that you see this in code. But in higher dimensions, in two dimensions, then you get, now I want to move this up. Okay, let's call this dx. You can also calculate a mixed derivative. Maybe I should pass that as a homework, how to calculate a mixed derivative. I should do that. Okay, there's one trick. If you calculate a second derivative, you can apply this stencil twice. And since the derivative at this point depends only on the neighboring values and not the value itself, if you calculate a second derivative, then the first derivative here depends on these points. The first derivative here depends on these points. So the second derivative here depends then on these points here and not the immediately neighboring points. And that has bad properties. So people usually choose a different definition for the second derivative. Let me write it down. This is the second derivative, f double prime at point I. This is minus f I minus 1 plus 2 f at point I minus f at I plus 1 divided by h squared. If you take this expression and take the limit of h goes to 0, you do get the usual second derivative, so it's correct in that respect. But this operator is not this operator applied twice. And this introduces some weird things that when you discretize functions, when you write them down in terms of basis functions and introduce a cutoff, that's what I call discretization. And many properties that hold in the continuum, take the limit n goes to infinity, many of these properties do not hold anymore. And you need to be very careful. For example, if you write down any kind of partial differential equation, Maxwell or something, you know, something like, what is it? Oh, the curl of the gradient is zero, for example. And then some of these properties do not hold anymore in the discrete. And here, for example, this is the second derivative, and that is different from the first derivative applied twice. And if someone is not familiar with discretization methods, it is mind-boggling why that would be the case. Because you have a nice proof in the continuum that some energy is conserved that might not hold in the discrete anymore. So you need to be careful, and this can be a source of instabilities. I would like to go into more detail in that, but don't have time to do that today. The point being is that when you have a discrete equation, then you need to be careful about which properties hold for the discrete derivative operators for this matrix D. And that might not be all the properties that you want to hold. And there's a whole science, a whole field of mathematics behind constructing good discretization methods and constructing derivative operators that have certain properties that you want to hold. For example, if you care about energy conservation, that might be important in a certain problem. And then you might be able to write down a proof of energy conservation in the continuum that relies on integration by parts. For example, with a scalar wave, then it's rather easy to see that you use summation by parts when you prove that energy conservation holds. And then your discrete operators, they might not satisfy this integration by parts property. People sometimes call it summation by parts, because it's a finite sum. But you can construct operators that do satisfy summation by parts, and then your discrete system also conserves energy. And whether energy conservation is important to you or not, that you'll see. And in the Maxwell equations, I mentioned this diff grad that is important, because you can calculate the magnetic field from a vector potential, and then the divergence of the vector field is zero. So in your numerical calculation, if you solve the Maxwell equations, if you discretize it wrong, then the divergence of the vector field is not zero. And whether that is important for your problem or not, it depends on your setup. But if it is important, then you either need to use a discretization method, and that's probably not a simple one like that, where it's guaranteed that the divergence of a curl is zero, or you need to fix your equations, that you add additional equations, that your equations remain valid even if the divergence of the magnetic field is non-zero, and then you add additional dissipation terms so that the divergence of the magnetic field gets dissipated away. And that may or may not work. And similar things happen with hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics is based on conservation of things, right? If you have some flow, neutron star, baryons don't just go away. They move from one point to the other, so the number of baryons is conserved. And if you discretize it the wrong way, then you might lose baryons, and then your whole solution might be complete nonsense. So all the partial differential, all the discretizations that people use for stellar hydrodynamics, they make sure that baryon number is conserved, and momentum, and energy. Except at the surface of the star, but that's a different thing. Okay, that was a bit theoretical today. I hope I can get fixed for Monday. Do you have more questions?
Is there any material I can read about the topic we discussed today in a more detailed way?
I'm not aware of any textbook that describes these things gives an nice overview over these things. There are certainly textbooks that describe, say, spectrum methods, and usually in great depth with a mathematical background and so on. There are also textbooks about finite differencing. They are usually much more applied because the people usually don't put much math behind it. And the other topics I mentioned, for example, discretizations that preserve certain continuum properties, or the integration by parts, there are papers or textbooks about that. But I'm not aware of any textbook that just describes discretization methods like that.
You say I don't understand certain things in a lecture, how am I supposed to catch up on this? I'm reading the Jupyter notebook, it's just like an application thing?
Yes, the notebook that I used last time, that was essentially just a sketch. I was going to go into more detail here. And I can point you to, say, a textbook or something that describes spectral methods in more detail. And that would go quite into more depth than what I did, because I'm just exposing the topic here. But you should be able to get more out of it. And I'll send around a reference. I'll send it to Mohammed that helps you catch up with that.
You mentioned that some properties may not hold in discrete case.
Yes.
Will it still not hold if you take the continuum limit, like h equals to 0?
Yeah, that's the problem sometimes.
Okay.
If h goes to 0, even in that limit, they don't hold. For example, I mentioned hydrodynamics earlier. In hydrodynamics, there is a feature called shock, where the solution becomes discontinuous. At the discontinuity, you need to be careful how you discretize it. And the shock moves with a particular speed, and that speed really depends that mass, energy, momentum is conserved. And if you do not conserve that in the discrete, then the shock speed will be wrong. And to my knowledge, the shock speed will not converge to the correct speed in the continuum limit. Even though in the continuum limit, you would conserve mass, energy, and so on. This is just the usual property that some things converge. Is it called smooth convergence? Sorry, I learned these things in German. And then some properties do not get recovered, even if something converges. Okay, you're taking this course here. Are you interested in partial differential equations? Do you have particular projects in mind? I mean, some of you are already working on your essays, I guess, and some of these essays might involve numerical methods. Not yet? Okay, you don't need to tell me. That's fine.
We don't know yet.
Okay.
I think partial differential equation methods might be helpful for our project. When you calculate like correlation functions or something.
They're still ordinary, and they're numerical integrators, so.
Okay.
Yeah. When people say integrate, that can mean two things. Sometimes it means just evaluating the area under an integral. That is what I call quadrature, and that's simpler. And that's what's needed to evaluate the integrals there, because you know the kernel of the integral everywhere. And other times people mean solving ordinary differential equations. I mentioned that on Monday, and I suggested using a package for that, because there the field is really very advanced. Of course, I only described very simple ODE solvers. There's much more out there, and I'd be happy to discuss, so you can look at the documentation of that package, which really gives a nice overview over what methods are available there. Okay. Thank you.